From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! The accounting firm Arthur Andersen fires its partner in charge of auditing the Enron Corporation, saying he'd ordered the destruction of thousands of documents and email messages. Today, we'll take a look at the money and connections that bought Enron power. As the company unravels in scandal, can they buy it innocence as well? We'll continue our conversation with two World War II conscientious objectors, and a Nigerian woman is sentenced to death. If she loses her appeal, she'll be buried up to her waist in sand and stoned. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. will not seek the death penalty for John Walker Lynn, the 20-year-old Californian who fought with the Taliban in Afghanistan. He was charged with conspiracy to kill U.S. citizens and will be tried in a civilian court in Virginia. He could face life in prison. Also yesterday, Lynn's parents accused the government of denying Lynn mail from his parents and refusing to let him see a lawyer during 45 days of interrogation. Invoking security concerns, President Bush has issued an executive order banning union representation at U.S. attorney's offices and at four other agencies in the Justice Department. Federal law bans strikes by federal employees, but White House officials are claiming that President Bush issued the order out of concern that union contracts would restrict the ability of workers in the Justice Department to protect Americans and national security. Union leaders are outraged and say Bush is exploiting September 11th to pursue a campaign against unions. U.S. and Philippine military officers in Manila began preparing joint operations yesterday against a Muslim extremist group linked to al-Qaeda in the southern Philippines. More than 600 U.S. troops are expected to be sent this month to train and advise 1,200 Philippine Army soldiers in how to destroy Abu Sayyaf. The operation would be the largest single deployment of U.S. military forces outside Afghanistan in the so-called War on Terrorism. But after Filipino military officials admitted the U.S. trainers would be issued live ammunition and licensed to fire back in self-defense, Filipino senators today demanded an intelligence briefing and warned that the operation might violate the Filipino constitution, which bans the permanent stationing of foreign troops in the Philippines. One opposition leader warned that both governments were retracing the circumstances that led to the U.S. military debacle in the Vietnam War. The UN is warning that the interim Afghan government faces possible collapse in the coming days if it is unable to pay more than 200,000 employees' salaries and back pay. They have not been paid in 6 months. The UN said the Afghan government had received only a fraction of the $20 million pledged by foreign governments at the talks in Bonn last month. The UN Development Program added Afghanistan will need $15 billion over the next 10 years to rebuild the country. U.S. Secretary of State General Colin Powell said the U.S. would free up $200 million in frozen government assets. Yasser Arafat's security forces announced they'd arrested the head of the militant faction that carried out the first assassination by Palestinians of an Israeli cabinet minister. Israel has been demanding the arrest of Ahmed Sadat, the general secretary general of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, since the ultranationalist Israeli tourism minister was shot dead by guerrillas in Jerusalem hotel in October. The arrest came as a Palestinian killed two Israeli civilians last night in the West Bank. Former Los Alamos scientist Wen Ho Lee maintains he was selected for prosecution because of his ethnic background and asserts the computer tapes he downloaded, which were the basis of his guilty plea, were not the crown jewels of nuclear weapons building, but largely the crown junk. In his newly published autobiography, My Country Versus Me, Lee acknowledges his downloading of computer tapes was a security violation, but he blames the multi-year FBI investigation of his activities and his jailing and solitary confinement for 9 months on espionage charges, partly on Washington hysteria and spineless bureaucrats. And he writes, quote, "Had I not been Chinese, I never would have been accused of espionage and threatened with execution." Arthur Andersen, the accounting firm accused of bungling Enron Corporation's audit, fired its partner in charge of reviewing the company's books yesterday. Andersen said he had ordered the destruction of thousands of documents and email messages after learning that the Securities and Exchange Commission had begun an investigation of Enron's accounting. U.S. relatives of victims of the September 11th attacks arrived in Afghanistan yesterday to meet Afghans who lost family in the U.S. bombing. The trip was organized by the U.S. human rights group Global Exchange. Four Americans are visiting Afghanistan for 3 days on the exchange. They include Rita Lassar, a retiree from New York who lost her brother Abe Zalmanowitz in the World Trade Center attack, and Kelly Campbell, an environmental coordinator from Oakland, California, whose brother Craig Amundsen was killed in the Pentagon attack. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. Last Tuesday, Rita Lassar came into our studio and met Masuda Sultan, who is an Afghan-American who returned to Afghanistan and met with her family. Her surviving family, 19 members, were killed in the U.S. bombing as they took refuge in a farmhouse. It was a remarkable meeting of two women from two different sides of the world who shared the same pain. Our website is democracynow.org.
I've already voted.
What do you mean you've already voted?
I've already voted.
The election is until November.
No, no, no. Not that kind of vote. I voted with my money.
Really?
Oh, yes. These days people don't vote. Money does. You see, Bush and Gore need tons of cash to run for office. We've got it. And we can get it to them. It's all completely legal. And in exchange, they basically set their policy agendas around our needs. Both of them. It's much more cost-effective.
What if you don't have that kind of cash?
Oh, it's okay. Just wait till November.
Paid for by billionaires for Bush or Gore. Because it doesn't really matter who you vote for, we've already bought them. www.billionairsforbushorgore.com.
Money votes from billionaires for Bush and more here on Democracy Now, back from exile. And it's wonderful to be with all the listeners of Pacifica stations and affiliates around the country, as well as WFMU in New York that has carried us through this difficult five-month period, and on cable access stations around the country and Dish Network Channel 9415, which is Free Speech TV's channel. Well, the latest story on Enron, the plot of the Enron scandal, thickens. Yesterday, Arthur Andersen, the accounting firm accused of bungling Enron Corporation's audit, fired its partner in charge of reviewing the company's books. Andersen said that the partner had ordered the destruction of thousands of documents and email messages after learning that the Securities and Exchange Commission had begun an investigation of Enron's accounting. Interestingly, George Bush was himself the subject of an SEC investigation into energy trading a decade ago. In 1990, George W. Bush sat on the board of directors of Harkin Energy Company and on their audit committee. Just before the company announced a $23 million loss, Bush sold some $850,000 worth of stock, which he later used to purchase the Texas Rangers baseball team. As in the Enron case, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, investigated the possible insider deal, but it brought no charges. Perhaps it's not surprising. The head of the SEC at the time was appointed by Bush the Elder. That's President George Bush. And the SEC's general counsel at the time, James Doty, actually helped George Bush buy the Texas Rangers with the Harkin stock money. Doty also hails from the law firm Baker & Botts. That's the law firm of Bush Sr.'s Secretary of State, James Baker. Baker is one of the most prominent figures in the first Bush administration, and he represented George W. Bush in his fight for the vote in Florida. Baker & Botts, the law firm, is also implicated in today's Enron scandal. It's the same firm that produced President Bush's appointee Lee Rosenthal, the Texas judge who was assigned to the employee and shareholder lawsuits against Enron. Just last week, Rosenthal denied a motion to freeze the assets of Enron executives and board members. She has since recused herself from the case. We're going to go down to Texas right now to Andrew Wheat, who is the research director of Texans for Public Justice. Welcome to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report.
Thanks a lot.
It's good to have you with us. Well, the plot thickens. Can you talk about this Texas judge, Lee Rosenthal, and what her connections to Enron are?
Sure. As you said in the introduction, Judge Lee Rosenthal she's a George W. Bush appointee to the federal bench, and she was appointed from the law firm of Baker Botts here in Texas. Baker Botts, as you explained, is a firm that has repeated connections to the Bush administration as well as to Enron. One of the named partners, James Baker, in addition to being Secretary of State under the former Bush White House, was a paid Enron lobbyist after he left the elder Bush's cabinet. During in 1994, the elder Bush, having just left office, took a victory tour of the Gulf region after the Gulf War. And while he was he and his entourage were being wined and dined in Kuwait, after Bush left town, a number of his members of his entourage, including James W. Baker, as well as one of the Army generals who had been in charge of the Gulf War, stayed on in Kuwait to lobby the Kuwait government on behalf of Enron to sell them contracts to replace their destroyed power plants from the war. The same firm as the firm that produced this District Judge Lee Rosenthal, and Ms. Rosenthal has now just recently recused herself from the cases, class action lawsuits against Enron and Arthur Andersen filed by the company's various investors, including its own employees through their pension fund. Ms. Rosenthal has recused herself because she apparently owned stock in Enron as recently as 2000. Now, just a week or so ago, she was downplaying her Enron stock holdings, saying that she hadn't held Enron stock, quote, for a very long time, certainly not any time in 2001, end quote. This week, she came back and acknowledged that she had had Enron stock and that she was recusing herself from the case. How much stock did Judge Rosenthal own in Enron? We don't know. Federal judges file personal financial disclosure forms that are available somewhat awkwardly to the public through something called the Judicial Conference of the United States. The Judicial Conference of the United States allows federal judges to essentially censor those forms before they're released to the public, and that's what Judge Lee Rosenthal has done. The forms that have been released on her personal holdings have large amounts of information blacked out, including the information that would show how much Enron stock Judge Rosenthal owned in Enron as recently as 2000.
So you're saying that she redacted the information?
Yeah, it's blacked out all over the form. There's blackout, and she claims, I think rightfully, that the U.S. government agency or this Judicial Conference of the United States, which is basically a group of judges that are self-regulating themselves, allows her to do this.
We're talking to Andrew Wheat, Research Director for Texans for Public Justice. This is a remarkable story. She is not the only person in this scandal that has recused herself. the Attorney General of the United States, John Ashcroft, has. Can you talk about that right through to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Houston? They've all recused themselves.
People are dropping like flies, and that's one of the fascinating aspects of this octopus of the Enron scandal, is that I think to understand it, you really have to take a step back and look. When Enron formed in 1985, it set out to really bring about a revolution in how electricity is delivered to American businesses and households. And I say a revolution because up until that point, we had a monopoly energy system in which, largely investor-owned utilities had a monopoly, and they were the only game in your town that could provide electricity. Enron wanted to overthrow that system and deregulate it to allow anybody to buy electricity from any provider. And to do so, it had to overthrow two major sets of vested interests. One were the government regulators that had grown up around the monopoly system, and the other, of course, were the investor-owned utilities that liked the monopoly system. Thank you very much. So they had to Enron in bringing about this electric revolution. The central ingredient that they needed was to amass vast political power, and they did this through a variety of means. One, aggressive campaign contributions. Number two, using the federal and state lobby systems to do the 1-2 punch on our elected officials. And then they also, to an extraordinary extent, use the revolving door. There are endless numbers of public officials like James Baker that left government office to go directly on Enron's payroll or went the other way. Public officials who are now public officials who, until their appointments, were working for Enron. And a good example of that is the new chairman of the Public Utility Commission here in Texas, Max Izaguirre, who was appointed by the Texas governor when previously he had run Enron of Mexico. So this is the background on how what Enron set out to do and how they went about doing it. And because they were so successful at this political game, the recusals are now everywhere you look. They're dropping like flies. As you said, the head of our Justice Department, John Ashcroft, has recused himself from the Justice Department's probe of this scandal, although he's punting the investigation to one of his own underlings. The same thing has happened here in Texas, where Texas Attorney General John Cornyn has reversed himself and just recently recused himself from our state's investigation of this. There again, John Cornyn is punting the investigation to one of his own underlings. As you said, the entire U.S. Attorney Office in Houston has recused himself, more than 100 attorneys in that office, who all were too close as friends and lovers of Enron employees to be able to approach this dispassionately. There are, of course, additional investigations going on by both the House and Senate of the U.S. government, and these people similarly have a challenge to meet in showing that they're truly independent of this company that they are investigating. 70% of all of our members of the U.S. Senate have taken money from Enron, and 43% of the House members have taken Enron money. This is not including, all the members of our Congress that have been lobbied by an army of Enron lobbyists, many of whom are former government officials themselves. So I think the real story here is, number one, the Enron crisis. I think it explodes a couple basic myths about America. It explodes the myth that we are a merit-based system in which people get ahead based on the merits of their own arguments, ideas, and actions. And it explodes the myth that we are all equal under the law, because in fact the laws are made by lawmakers, who are at the bid and call of entities such as Enron.
Andrew, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I want to ask you about the man who's replaced Attorney General John Ashcroft to lead this investigation, Larry Thompson. Andrew Wheat, our guest, is with Texans for Public Justice, talking about the Enron scandal. You're listening to War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Back. Why we all gotta look, why we all gotta act the same. I save your borderline, don't bother trying to act tame. Everything I do, I do for the first time. I got a big crush on you, and it's fresh in my mind. Can I follow you home? Just listen to you think. Leave my footprints on your cups, leave my hairs in your sink. Try living by my rules for a day. I tell you, nobody would die. And there'd be lots of stuff to say.
Born a Lion, Ani DeFranco here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In a minute, we're going to talk about the woman in northern Nigeria who faces stoning to death for a conviction of adultery. But first, we're going to finish this conversation about the Enron scandal. Our guest is Andrew Wheat, Research Director for Texans for Public Justice. The man, Larry Thompson, the Deputy Attorney General, who has been put in charge of this investigation since Ashcroft's recusal. The New York Times says, Mr. Thompson is proving to be a reliable second-in-command for Mr. Ashcroft in the White House, a top federal prosecutor in Atlanta during the presidency of Mr. Bush's father. Mr. Thompson won his credentials with the Bush camp in 1991 when he helped guide Clarence Thomas through a tumultuous confirmation as a Supreme Court justice. Some Democratic groups argue Thompson, too, has ties to Enron. In Atlanta, he was lawyer at the firm King & Spalding, which represented Enron, but he himself did no work for Enron, according to a Justice Department official. What about him and the other largest campaign contributions going to people like Texas powerhouse Congressman Tom DeLay?
Yeah, I think, you know, here again the question becomes, the Enron, because of the scale of Enron's influence and money that it spread around, we've got a crisis of biblical proportions because we're sort of in a position of who among us is without sin in the federal and state government systems, who can cast the first stone on the Enron investigation, or who can be expected to go about it in an independent fashion. And we sort of look in vain for such an individual, and we have to ask ourselves, how did we get to this point where there really are few options and mechanisms within our government system for an independent investigation of a scandal of this magnitude? And the problem, of course, will go back ultimately to the problem of money in politics. How is it that we've allowed ourselves to let our ostensibly public officials become so beholden to private campaign contributions, to soft money, and to the lobby? And that's really, I think, the root of this particular evil that we're facing. When you look at the problem of individuals who appear to be on the face incapable of mounting an investigation, I think probably, you know, beyond Larry Thompson, some of the other individuals you mentioned, like Tom DeLay, I think the larger concern in my mind is somebody like Harvey Pitt. This is George W. Bush's appointee to be chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission that's heading up an Enron probe. who is Harvey Pitt? Harvey Pitt has, prior to his appointment, has spent many years defending the big six accounting firms from the kinds of charges that Enron is facing today for cooking its books. Harvey Pitt himself is an author of a book in the 1990s that gave guidance to accounting firms and corporations, in which he directed them to shred their documents, any potentially incriminating documents short of a government subpoena. And this is exactly the case that we're facing today here with Arthur Andersen. It's just made a scapegoat of one of its partners that was heading up the Enron investigation and gave the order to shred documents up until the day after a subpoena was first issued by the SEC. Is Harvey Pitt the kind of man that's going to be, if you'll excuse the expression, a pit bull for the public's interests? In this case, I don't think so. Pitt ran an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in December when he said that, you know, we should be trying to prevent future Enrons rather than looking for scapegoats. Can you imagine somebody saying something like that about a street criminal, that we're not looking for scapegoats, we just want to prevent this from happening again? A lot of people would say that's a false dichotomy. The way to prevent this from happening again is to go after the people that were responsible.
Well, Andrew Weed, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Research Director for Texans for Public Justice, shedding a lot of light on the Enron scandal and the implications for it in this country for those in power. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to another story. After years of pressure from women's rights activists in the United States and around the world, the White House has finally paid lip service to the plight of women in Afghanistan when it's politically expedient to do so. Now we're going to turn to another country that is very valuable to the United States for its oil. It's Africa's most populous country, Nigeria. According to the Northern Nigerian state, we are going to look at a woman named Safiya Husseini. Her punishment is going to be, at least according to a court sentence that was handed down, now it has been put off, to be buried to her waist in the sand and killed by public stoning with stones as big as a fist. Last October, Safiya Husseini, who's 35, was sentenced in a court in the Nigerian state of Sokoto based on the word of the father and her pregnancy. Initially, Husseini claimed she'd been raped and was convicted under the most severe interpretation of Islamic Sharia law. For a man to be convicted, he must confess. Or there must be witnesses. Husseini's alleged rapist was acquitted. Husseini says it's because she's poor and a woman that she'll be executed for having a child. But in an appeal to the court yesterday, Husseini said her baby, now 11 months old, was fathered by her former husband, not the married man who says she says raped her. If she can prove it was not adultery, she could be acquitted, since having a husband's child after divorce is not an offense under Sharia law. Husseini won a reprieve until March in her appeal yesterday, but international outrage over her case and the moral police and force in Nigeria is growing. Over 75 members of the European Parliament have urgently petitioned the Nigerian president to stop the execution, calling the punishment inhuman, barbaric, and cruel. Although Nigeria has inflicted harsh Sharia punishments, including hangings and amputations, nobody has yet been stoned to death. We're going to go now to Asma Abdel Halim, who's a women's rights activist and lawyer from the Sudan. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Can you explain this story?
Well, the story is, as you have told it, the woman is accused because she gave birth to a child, and she claims that she was raped. But the law applied to her is not taking her word for being raped, which is amazing because Sharia, in its most traditional way, however you take it, does not take pregnancy as evidence of zina, because zina is the crime of consensual sexual intercourse between two adults. So pregnancy could be the result of zina or of rape. Therefore, pregnancy in itself is not proof of zina. And as long as there is no proof to the contrary, that is to say, there is no proof that she was not raped or that she had consensual sexual relationship with this man, then there is no zina. She can never, in any way, in however way you take Sharia, it's traditional, it's action, whatever you want to describe it, there is no way to convict the woman.
You come from the Sudan, where an 18-year-old woman received a similar conviction in December, sentenced to execution by stoning for adultery. Can you talk about women's lives under Sharia law and the kind of attention that these two cases are getting? We're hearing almost nothing about it in the United States, but it is getting international attention otherwise.
Well, exactly. It is getting international attention, I think, because of the most unjust way it is being applied. The application of Sharia and the rules of Sharia in these cases are very difficult. To prove zina, it is very difficult. Even if you can produce four witnesses to the zina, it is absolutely difficult for those witnesses to come up with the same story, because in Sharia, the least discrepancy in the testimony of those witnesses will do away of their with their testimony. Not only that, but they are subject to punishment for accusing someone of zina without being able to prove it. The lives of women have been subject to some political measures that takes women and put them under this sort of made by the government draconian laws so as to subject the people to a certain measure where they can pledge allegiance to anything, be obedient. But I think it backfired, because allegiance and obedience does not come from the application of this. In the case in the Sudan, it is a Christian woman. She is not even a Muslim woman. And the most amazing thing is that the Supreme Court, the Federal Supreme Court in the Sudan, have overturned not just one, but I think more than one case where the lower courts have taken pregnancy to be evidence of zina, and the Supreme Court said no, as long as the woman claims that she was raped and no evidence to the contrary, then she was raped. You have to take her confession in total, not just divide it. Believe her that she had intercourse, but disbelieve her when she was raped. And the amazing thing is that despite these Supreme Court rulings, the lower courts in certain parts of the Sudan are passing judgments on the slightest piece of evidence that they can find. For example, in Nigeria, the father, what is the father saying? Yes, his daughter had a child. But he cannot prove that she was not raped. He cannot prove that she had a consensual relationship with another man while she was married. But this has not been taken into consideration.
Do you think that the reprieve until March in her appeal yesterday is coming from the international outrage?
Well, it could be. It could be, and it could be because higher courts would like to weigh this. Nigeria has, a good system of courts and of law application, and the appeals take time. And I think it could be a step just to avert this international pressure and decide the case without the pressure. But the thing that I fear is the public opinion created by these judgments, because the public opinion might take this very strongly against the woman, and her life would be impossible during these 3 months. What's she going to do if she is living in a community where the whole community is treating her as a woman who committed zina, as a woman who contravened the law, and as a woman who brought all this international pressure into that community? She's going to pay for all of this, and she is guilty of none of it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Asma Abdel Halim. If people want to get information on this case, where can they go on the web?
Well, there are many. If you search just for Islam and women or Islam, then you can get about, tens or hundreds of sites.
Well, thank you very much. We also know Equality Now has taken up the case, and you can just put that into a search engine, and you'll find the story of Safia Husseini. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. You're listening to Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with part two of our discussion about conscientious objectors in World War II, yesterday we spoke with Rick Tejada Flores, who is co-producer and co-director of the film The Good War and Those Who Refuse to Fight It. It's airing on PBS stations around the country this week. This is just an excerpt of what Rick Tejada Flores had to say.
I was a Vietnam-era CO, and in fact, my draft counselor had been a Quaker who went to jail in World War II, but I really never realized what a difficult position it was. We built a huge peace movement in the 60s. There was no peace movement during World War II. You couldn't go to Canada. These guys were all alone, and they were very courageous. And they were essentially ahead of their times, and the world did catch up with them. The anti-apartheid movement succeeded, the civil rights movement succeeded, and they were there all along, as they call bearing witness, and they stuck to their principles, and they were right, and I think history has proved them right.
That was Rick Tejada Flores speaking with us about the people who refused to fight in World War II, and we're joined by two of those people right now. On the telephone, George Hauser, a conscientious objector, one of the founders of CORE, and Bill Sutherland, another conscientious objector from World War II, an African liberation activist who ended up spending much of his life in Tanzania, where he was a civil servant. He recently co-authored the book with Matt Meyer, Guns and Gandhi in Africa, Pan-African Insights on Nonviolence, Armed Struggle, and Liberation in Africa. Rick Tejada Flores just talked about what war resistors went on to do in their lives, seminal in the civil rights movement and founding Pacifica Radio, Lou Hill, who was in a detention camp in World War II, in fighting for the liberation of Africa. George Hauser, can you talk about the period after you served time at Danbury for refusing to fight, and the civil rights work you did?
Yes, I was based in Chicago for several years, from 1941 until 1944. I was working with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, a religious peace organization, and my task was to organize groups among particularly college students in the Chicago area. One of the groups was set up at the University of Chicago, and there was an interracial group. They immediately ran into some difficulty getting service at some of the restaurants along 63rd Street near the campus of the University of Chicago. And out of that, we developed a strategy of dealing nonviolently with this kind of discrimination. We had read the book by Shridharani, War Without Violence, and we were familiar with Gandhian methods in the struggle for freedom in India. So we developed what we called the Chicago Committee of Racial Equality, which became a national organization in 1943, which we called the Congress of Racial Equality. I served as executive secretary for 10 years in National CORE, and one of the major projects we had was dealing with the problem of segregation and discrimination in interstate travel. We organized the first Freedom Ride. The one which got great publicity was in 1961, but in 1947, we had 16 young, we were young men then, who traveled through some of the southern states, refusing to ride Jim Crow. And I think there were 12 arrests that took place during that the 2 weeks that we traveled. And we learned what happens when you refuse to ride Jim Crow. That is, the whites were riding in the back, the blacks were riding in the front. And the kind of reaction we got from our bus, the other bus passengers, from the police, from the crowds outside, from the bus drivers. And we had, as I say, a good many arrests that took place. But we also were able to get a good look into what kind of reaction you get when you refuse to obey a law such as the Jim Crow law, as we had refused to obey the Conscription Act at the time of the Second World War. That was one of the outreaches. Then the other was I was led directly into the Africa field, partly as a result of my long contacts with Bill Sutherland, and we organized the American Committee on Africa, which I was executive director for 26 years.
Which was seminal in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. Bill Sutherland, can you talk about that? The connection between pacifism and civil rights and Africa liberation work.
Well, I think that developments that people don't know about is the way that these movements tied into one another. In fact, the French were going to explode a nuclear device in the Sahara, and as a result of that, the anti-colonial movement, the civil rights movement, and the anti-war movement joined together in opposing this move by the French. We didn't stop it, but we kept them from exploding anymore. Unfortunately, they went to the South Pacific. But that and during the anti-Vietnam War period, the African liberationists joined with the American anti-Vietnam War movement in opposing that war, and gave messages of support. Now, as far as the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, we were the major group in America who supported that. But that was, of course, a worldwide movement, and I think there's going to be a documentary pretty soon on the anti-apartheid movement throughout the world, and the pacifists throughout the world were leading that support.
As you spent 4 years in prison in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, during a war that was extremely, I don't know if you can say popular in the United States, but had the support of the majority of people here, and yet you were one of some 40,000 people who refused to fight in that war. What were your thoughts in prison in these 4 years? Did the time you were there lay the groundwork for you for the future? Or were you pretty well established before you went in, which is probably why you went in as a conscientious objector?
Well, I was pretty well established, but you're right that it determined my life in the future. And I like to say that we didn't refuse to fight because we were fighting for principles that were proclaimed for the World War II, but we were fighting in our own way for those principles. And we didn't limit it to patriotism and fighting for a country, but we felt that these principles were worldwide and that we were fighting for human rights, which is a very popular way to say it today.
Bill Sutherland and George Hauser, two World War II conscientious objectors. We'll be back with them in a minute.
Set out on this journey, there were no doubts in our mind. We set our eyes to the distance, we'll find what we would find. We took courage from our numbers, what we saw we did not fear. Sometimes we glimpse a shadow falling, the shadow would disappear. Thoughts kept returning. There's something the boy said as we turned to go. Said you'll never see our faces again. Maybe food for a carrion crow. Every step we took today, our thoughts would always stray. The wind on the moor so wide.
Something the boy said, Sting, here on the War and Peace Report, breaking the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with Bill Sutherland and George Hauser, resisted World War II, refused to fight. I did this interview yesterday just after the program and asked George Hauser how he stood up against going to the front when this was World War II, such a popular war.
Very strongly opposed to fascism, Nazism, any kind of totalitarianism. And I think all of us who were in that position would have said that if we were in the European theater of war, we would have been among those who were rescuing Jewish people, for example, and we would have been the ones that would have been liquidated by Hitler, because we would have been in the front lines opposing the spread of the evil doctrine of Nazism. And we applied that to our own country in terms of the great injustices that were being done here, in particularly in the field of race relations, where we could get a hold of it in some way or other. So there was no question about our opposition to any form of injustice. And we felt that a great part of that was the terrible things that happen in warfare when you drop bombs on a city like Dresden and kill a couple of hundred thousand people or drop atomic bombs. These are acts of terrorism and of mass destruction, which in final analysis don't solve the basic problems which we have to face. We were opposed to this.
George Hauser, I want to start with you and then ask Bill Sutherland about President Mandela's initial support for the bombing of Afghanistan. He is going to be holding meetings with Muslim leaders this month to apologize for his unqualified support for the U.S.-led coalition against Afghanistan. There are 1 million Muslims in South Africa, angered first by a joint press conference last November between U.S. President George Bush and Mandela, in which Mandela expressed his support. And then he confirmed his views during a December meeting at a mosque in the port city of Durban, and also said he believed Osama bin Laden should be captured and tried for the attacks. At the time, Mandela was criticized for not displaying the statesmanship and even-handedness that characterizes his politics. The Muslim youth movement criticized him for not displaying commitment to the rule of law, which demands a trial before conviction. He has said that his initial statements were one-sided and overstated, and that he wanted to apologize for giving the impression of being, quote, insensitive and uncaring about the suffering inflicted upon the Afghan people and country in the course of the so-called war against terror. What is your response to that?
Well, we have to get into the mind of Mandela. He would have been very strongly opposed to acts of terrorism. It is true that the African National Congress, which he led and was in so many years in prison, carried on what they called an armed struggle. But one of the basic principles they had was that there would be no terrorism which would endanger human life. So there's no question about the fact that Mandela would be opposed to terrorism, and I think it was an immediate reaction to the awful display of the Twin Towers being hit by planes. And there was an immediate reaction to that. Who knows what kind of pressure he was put under to make some kind of statement, because he was a key person. He may have been the one person in the world who could have played a leading role in any negotiations that might have taken place between the United States and bin Laden. He had the respect of all sides in this. And I think that he had to clarify what he meant when he made his initial statements in which he was opposing terrorism. And I think taking the position that those who are taking such action should be subject to judicial review and should be put on trial in some decent court, world court, not thrown into an American military tribunal.
I'm looking at a piece by Farah Khan that came out in Interpress Service and is commondreams.org, where it's also stated that the deputy South African President Jacob Zuma conveyed a similar message as Nelson Mandela is doing. He, wearing a checkered Palestinian scarf and keffiyeh, he called for a more fair application of the term terrorism. He said it was not even-handed to apply the epithet only to the attacks on the United States and not to the fallout experienced by Afghan civilians. Bill Sutherland, could you elaborate?
Yes, well, I think that's quite right, that in this fight against terrorism, it's forgotten that terrorism was supported by United States in Latin America and in Africa and other places as well, and that in Guatemala and in El Salvador and so on, you have had a support of terrorism. And I don't distinguish between the killing of innocent people by the terrorists, as they were called, and an atom bomb or the bombing of Dresden. I mean, it's all a very bad thing. I think that Mandela forgot that the anti-apartheid movement and the African National Congress was considered a terrorist group, and he himself was considered a terrorist at one time, and that that, as George said, it was an immediate off-the-cuff reaction to the bombing of the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, and that it wasn't a thought-through thing for him.
In your book, Guns and Gandhi in Africa, which you wrote with Matt Meyer, you take on several case studies, Tanzania, Ghana, Kenneth Kaunda, Zambia, and Riddles of Violence and Nonviolence, and National Liberation, the Struggles Against Colonialism in Southern Africa. Would you care to discuss what you mean by the Gandhi approach when it comes to, say, Zambia?
Yes, well, in terms of Zambia, Kenneth Kaunda was the one person I knew who was a Gandhian on principle. And he had gone to India, and he had used the Gandhian approach in the liberation of his own country. But the main thing is that in all of these countries, in the beginning, nonviolence was the way. It wasn't until the Congo and the Sharpeville incident in South Africa that people felt that they had to turn to violence. But
in Sharpeville, how many people died in the Sharpville killings in South Africa?
Well, I think
by
that
the
there
apartheid
were
regime.
Yeah, there were about 100 who died in that, because the police shot them in the backs as they were running away.
George Hauser, you were trying to say something?
Yeah, in Sharpeville there were something like 150 who were wounded and 69 who were killed. Mm. And of course this was the time at which the South African government outlawed the African National Congress and the Pan-Africanist Congress and other opposition groups, so that they were left with very little access, since they were banned as organizations. And they had to consider what, how shall we carry on our struggle? That was the issue at that time. And Bill is quite right that the Congo crisis was terribly important, coming at about the same time, and became the issue that introduced the Cold War into Africa.
But George, I think we ought to say too that even after the African National Congress decided that it would engage in armed struggle, many of the actions that were carried on for the freedom of South Africa were nonviolent mass actions that were very effective.
I agree with you. I think nonviolent action was much more responsible for winning the battle than the very limited armed struggle that was able to take place. I think you'd agree with that.
And what about Tanzania?
Well, in Tanzania, I call Nyerere a pragmatist, and he, from a practical point of view, he felt that the nonviolent way was the way to gain independence, and that was the independence of the mainland. You see, I mean, it was first Tanganyika that became independent. And nonviolence was a method used there. There was a little different story in terms of Zanzibar, where violence was used. But in Tanganyika, in the mainland, Nyerere felt that you don't use violence just to be violent. You use it if there's no other way, and they were able to gain their independence by nonviolent methods.
Bill Sutherland and George Hauser, two World War II conscientious objectors. They are the subjects of a new PBS documentary airing around the country this week. It's called The Good War and Those Who Refuse to Fight It. And that does it for our program. If you'd like to email us, send us mail to mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, with help from Miranda Kennedy and Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland's at the helm at WBIX.org. We want to thank Manhattan Neighborhood Network, as well as Downtown Community Television, where we're based, in a Firehouse Garret. Our website, again, democracynow.org. Also, special thanks to all the Pacifica stations, listeners, and affiliates around the country. It is wonderful to be back. And we urge you to let us know your thoughts at that email address, mail@democracynow.org. We are broadcasting from the studios of support from listeners all over the country. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
It's you I'm talking to. Well, you I'm talking to now. Why do you look so